South Florida braces for Hurricane Isaias, and back to school goes online. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. High winds, rain, and high seas are all in the forecast as Hurricane Isaias turns north toward South Florida. The storm will be the closest brush for most in the region since Hurricane Irma almost 3 years ago. Isaias is also the first hurricane to test some flood protection projects put in place after Irma. The coronavirus surge is forcing Florida's largest school district to start the year online.
We believe it is in the best interest of our students and employees to delay the return to the schoolhouse and commence the 2021 school year from a distance.
We hear from Miami-Dade School Superintendent Alberto Carvalho later on this hour. Your phone calls coming up on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio. Parts of South Florida here on this Friday afternoon are under a hurricane watch. Other parts are under a tropical storm warning. It's the latest advisory the National Hurricane Center has put out. Tropical storm conditions and possible hurricane conditions will be felt along the coast of South Florida this weekend. Isaias is the ninth named storm this year, and we're just getting into August, several weeks before the historic peak of hurricane season. You remember the other eye storm that hit South Florida last time, Irma? That was in September. Here we are at the end of July. The activity is also happening to coincide with the coronavirus pandemic, of course. Several state-run coronavirus testing sites have closed ahead of the storm, and they're expected to be reopened on Wednesday morning at the latest. Taking your phone calls, how are you preparing for the hurricane? Your concerns about the storm during a pandemic, 800-743-WLRN, shutters, no shutters, cleaning up the backyard. When do you kind of put your hurricane plan in action? 800-743-9576. Also on Twitter, at WLRN. Meteorologist Ray Hawthorne is with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. He is with us, the latest on the hurricane. Ray, welcome back to WLRN. We are still, maybe an hour or so away from the 2 o'clock advisory on this Friday afternoon. What can you tell us about the storm?
Yeah, right now the storm is located just about 300 miles to the southeast of Nassau. It's moving through the central and southeastern Bahamas right now. Top sustained winds as of the latest advisory at 11 o'clock, 75 miles per hour. Unlike a lot of the slow-moving storms like Dorian last year, for example, this one's moving quite a bit faster. It's moving toward the northwest, right around 16 miles per hour. And again, as you mentioned, there are hurricane watches now in effect, basically from Palm Beach County northward to the Treasure Coast, and tropical storm warnings are in effect farther south into Broward and much of Miami-Dade County.
WLRN's environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich is also with us. Jenny, what are the preparations here on this Friday afternoon for South Florida? What are we seeing kind of be put into place from emergency operation centers or closures or reductions in services? Anything like that?
Right. So shelters are on standby. None of them have opened yet, but they certainly are on standby. Miami-Dade County has shut down its COVID testing facilities, those tents we see in parking lots. Mm-hmm. And bus transit is going to continue running right now. It looks like Miami-Dade County is going to avoid sustained tropical storm force winds. That's according to the mayor as of this morning. So they're going to keep buses running, but they could shut them down, you know, if we do get those winds. But for now, it doesn't look like we're going to have those sustained winds.
Ray, focus in your radar on the cone and where those winds are expected to be felt in South Florida, Palm Beach South, at the highest velocity and wind. Give us some insight there, could you?
Yeah, sure. So the tropical storm force winds, the most likely time of arrival for those for Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade County, would likely be on Saturday afternoon. The highest chance of those tropical storm force winds would be in Palm Beach County, but there absolutely is a chance and a decent chance as well. And Broward County is particularly right along the coast. And depending on the very exact track, and even just a very small shift, well within the realm of average forecast error, even a small shift to the west could bring sustained tropical storm force winds right along the coast, in particular of Miami-Dade County coming up on on Saturday afternoon. I should mention that the forecast from the Hurricane Center has the, again, if we were to use the exact center of the cone, which we shouldn't always do, but it's
right.
barely
don't
offshore
do that. That's
of
right.
Parts of, yeah, it's barely offshore of Palm Beach County, just a very small shift to the west. Average air time's about 40 to 50 miles, 24 hours out, which is what we're looking at. And so even that small shift could bring those tropical storm force sustained winds right to the coast.
Just a degree difference in latitude or longitude can make a big difference. Mark in Fort Lauderdale wants to get into the nitty-gritty. Mark, go ahead. You are on the radio.
Well, hello. How are you?
Good. Nice to talk to you again. Go ahead.
Thank you. I was wondering, can you provide us with the coordinates of the storm?
I will get Ray back here for this coordinates of the storm. I can tell you that here in South Florida and Miami, Jenny, we learn latitude and longitude each and every hurricane season. 25 degrees, 80 degrees is about roughly where Miami is located. And that's generally where we need to watch for South Florida. Ray, are you back with us?
Yeah, sure am.
Yeah, give us a sense. We're looking for the latitude, longitude of the storm here at the latest advisory on this Friday afternoon.
Yeah, the latest has it at 21.7 north. The longitude is at 74.5 west. That's the most recent longitude. And I think you were mentioning a little bit about just how far west the system could potentially get. And 80 degrees is just about right on the coast. And the forecast, again, taking the center line, is very, very close to that. And if you were just to go a little bit to the left, that would bring it on the left side of the cone, to bring the center of the storm in at about 81 and a half west. And so taking that left-hand side would certainly bring those stronger winds in.
Well, I mean, you know, we're geeking out on latitude and longitude, but 81 degrees west would take us on the sand in South Florida, if not a little bit, you know, to I-95, the Turnpike area.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why that's important to focus on the entire cone. Indeed, it is possible that, Tom, that it certainly could end up on the other side of the cone as well, which would be a much, much, much better scenario. Of course, it could end up just being a breezy day with occasional showers, but we're really splitting hairs here with regard to, in terms of just a small shift in the track that's well within the average forecast error.
Yeah, Jenny Stiletovich is still with us, the environmental reporter for us here in Miami at WLRN. Jenny, this really harkens back to maybe a Hurricane Matthew kind of situation where we're really tracking that eye within just a few miles to make sure the worst part of the winds hopefully stay offshore.
Right, and this storm, seems a little compact. The hurricane force winds only extend 35 miles from the center. The tropical storm force winds go way further at 200-plus miles. When you think about the extent of that wind field, 75 miles across for hurricane force winds.
Ray, I'm going to let you go here in a moment, but what are you looking for? What questions do you have for the 2 o'clock advisory that's coming up in about 40 minutes or so?
Yeah, the 2 o'clock advisory is typically an intermediate update, and the big questions there are the latest intensity reconnaissance aircraft flying through the system right now. Based on satellite imagery and based on some of the initial reports here, not likely to see too many changes for the 2 o'clock update. I think at 5 o'clock, that could be more substantial. And I will say that there's going to be another set of model runs coming out, a vaunted European model, which is very widely respected, will be coming out here in about the next hour and a half to 2 hours, and that may have an impact on what the 5 o'clock advisory looks like. And there is some possibility at that point that the Hurricane Center may go ahead and extend or expand some of those watches or upgrade them. Again, completely dependent upon what the hurricane hunters find and what some of the latest model data is by 5 o'clock.
Meteorologist Ray Hawthorne with us with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Ray, thanks for your work and appreciate the update here.
You're very welcome, Tom.
Talking about the head of the storm season, certainly in the thick of it now, right? Well, we're not even in the thick of it, right, Jenny? We're just really starting to get into the thick of it. But boy, we've got the storm on the radar and watching here in South Florida. 800-743-9576, an early early start to this storm season in terms of how the velocity is picking up, the volume of storms picking up. 800-743-WLRN. Your questions, your concerns, share your hurricane plan with us. Jenny Seledovich, WLRN's environmental reporter, still with us. What has stood out to you, Jenny, as this system has kind of made its way across the Atlantic and into the Caribbean?
Well, I think that one of the most noticeable things was how tricky it was to forecast because it started out so big. It was long and elongated, and it didn't have a well-defined eye. And, without the eye, it makes it really hard for the models to forecast what's going to happen with it. And so that eye, even as it was approaching Hispaniola, was still struggling to sort of become well-defined. There was yesterday morning, the National Weather Service suggested that the eye might get torn up and shredded as it passed over those mountains, and it did not. It emerged and has become a little better defined, but there's still, there's sheer and dry air that I think that's why they probably downgraded. It had been at 100 miles an hour top sustained winds, and now it's at 90. So they knocked it back from a Cat 2 to a Cat 1. But it just shows how tricky these storms are to forecast when they're really, really big and they don't get good and organized.
And it's also that storm classification also so important for local planning and local emergency operating centers about what types of plans they put into place and pulling triggers on shelters, for instance, or other kinds of emergency measures. And of course, all of this is under the cloud of the pandemic and COVID-19. You spoke with Frank Rollison recently. He's the Miami-Dade head of emergency management. And he said the county is looking into hiring folks from an events company that typically staffs Hard Rock Stadium and other venues.
We've asked them for 1,000 people. And when I talked to him on the phone the other day, he said, man, I don't know, I can get you 1,000. I said, hey, you get me 500, you get me 250. It's what I don't have.
It really is an open question here about the staffing of hurricane shelters, isn't it, Jenny? Even as, we've got a pretty serious storm. It looks to be just offshore, but a storm nonetheless.
Right. And when we talked, he said, they have 3,000 county employees designated to work in these shelters, but he's worried that they won't all show up because they'll have families they have to take care of or they'll be sick. I mean, with COVID, it's just the level of uncertainty is so much higher. And so he turned to this events company. The problem is that to work on a school district facility in a school site, you have to be vetted. And he said maintaining a list of vetted workers has proved to be a little tricky.
We're talking about preparations for Hurricane Isaias, as it is a Category 1 storm, waiting for the latest update from the National Hurricane Center in a little bit under an hour as we're live on this Friday afternoon here on the South Florida Roundup. 800-743-9576 to share your preparation plans. David in Coral Springs is joining us. David, thanks for calling in and listening to WLRN. Your thoughts?
No problem. Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Yeah, I'm just very concerned about our businesses. Our business communities are being hit by COVID is one thing, but now we've got to go into our disaster recovery program and wanted to make sure that they are aware of that. I work with a company that does just that. But I just want to make sure that they're prepared. This is not the time to practice your program. You've got to make sure it's already been working and want to make sure that the businesses are aware of that so that they can address it.
David, I'm curious, with the businesses you work for, with the work at home in place for some folks who are able to do that, or even reduction in business operations ordered because of the pandemic, I'm thinking, for instance, of bars and restaurants, what are you hearing from companies you work for? Are they fully staffed and now have to deal with the hurricane, or are they already dispersed because of the pandemic?
Tom, I have both equations. I have some that are working from home, and their businesses have now switched and, shall we say, have pivoted towards that end, and they're now focused on trying to make sure that their employees are not only safe, but that the data and information that they're transporting is safe, because a lot of people may not have firewalls. The hackers don't stop because of the pandemic or stuff like that. So it's important to understand that. And then on the other side of the equation, you have people that are in staff and trying to figure out how to protect that information going forward.
David, I appreciate it. Stay safe for you and your colleagues and family there in Coral Springs. 800-743-9576. Hurricane Isaias spinning offshore, moving to the north-northwest, hopefully taking a bend to the north over the next several hours, and watching that cone of concern, but knowing full well that effects of the storm can be felt way outside that that cone. Jenny Stiletovich, the environmental reporter here at WLRN, and we're going to talk more about water in a moment, but that concern kind of outside the cone really gets down to rain, doesn't it, Jenny?
Yes, and they the rain forecast now, it's 3 up to 4-6 inches. There's some concern it can be higher in local spots. But yeah, the rain is definitely a concern considering some of the flooding problems we've had.
What has the storm brought into the Caribbean as we kind of look at the track it's already taken? What kind of damage has it left behind?
You know, I think the forecast called for like between 4 and 8 inches of rain across the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
It was just moving across the Bahamas today, so I'm not sure that they've had too many impacts. Yeah, the last thing I saw, people were still lining up to buy supplies.
Yeah, they still haven't been able to get reports out. And of course, if it takes the track it's on, that worst part of the storm, the northeast quadrant, is forecast to hit the part of the Bahamas that was devastated just a year ago by Hurricane Dorian, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. Stick with us, Jenny. We got a lot more to talk about as Hurricane Isaias continues to move toward the region. We're going to continue to hear your stories about preparation. 800-743-WLRN. Coming up next, what about the water? Are flood control measures ready for this storm? More of your phone calls and tweets at WLRN is the handle on Twitter, and 800-743-9576 as the South Florida Roundup continues. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The forecast for Hurricane Isaias includes up to 6 inches of localized rain and storm surges, perhaps 3 to 5 feet from Biscayne Bay north to Palm Beach. High tide in Miami on Saturday. It'll be around 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. The storm and water come as July has been wetter than normal across the region, and some water storage areas are full. The storm is the first hurricane to test resilience efforts put in place after Hurricane Irma in 2017. So how does your neighborhood look after a heavy rain? What are you preparing for with Hurricane Isaias? Do you live in an area that usually experiences flooding? And how are you preparing for this storm and potentially the storms to come? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN is our handle on Twitter. Alan Dodd now is with us, the City of Miami Chief Resilience Officer and the Department of Public Works Director. Alan, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Hi, it's great to talk with you.
Yeah, you as well. Jenny Stiletovich, WLRN's environmental reporter, also with us now via Skype. Alan, what does your department expect from this storm? What are you preparing for?
Well, there's a couple different areas. We know that we're going to be having a significant amount of rain. And so we've been spending a lot of time checking our stormwater system, trying to make sure it's as clean as possible where we have hot spots, and trying to prevent those flooding points from occurring. The second thing is wind. We expect that there's going to be very strong winds. There'll be down branches and trees that will be blocking the road. And so we have teams that are prepared to go out and help to clear the roads, working with the Emergency Management Department.
And the stormwater pumps, tested and working, backup power, can you reassure those folks that rely on those pumps even during heavy storms?
Yes. We have 13 stormwater pump stations in the city that the city manages. In the last 48 hours, we've gone out and tested every single one of them. If they have a generator, we made sure that the generator was operational. Some of them don't have generators at the location, so we have portable generators that could be moved to where they need to be. We have pre-positioned some generators throughout the city, and also some portable pumps in key places in the city, so that if we have to respond to flooding problems, we'll be able to do that as well.
Alan, what's changed since Hurricane Irma with these preparations now for this storm?
Well, I think really, the biggest thing that has changed for us is the emphasis on the stormwater system, on preventive maintenance to make sure that pump stations are up and running, that we have backup power, that we go through a deliberate process started several months ago to identify where those hotspots are and that we're cleaning them, that we're trimming branches from electrical lines that could cause people to lose power. It's very much about preparation before the storm event gets there.
Jenny Stiletovich, WLRN's environmental reporter. The lessons from Irma are still fresh, not only the power outages, but also the localized flooding, particularly that we saw in the Brickell neighborhood after, or rather during, Hurricane Irma, right?
Right, right. Brickell was underwater. I still, there are many pictures of
yeah.
people, you know, die knee deep in water and cars submerged. I think Alan and I talked a little bit about this. Over Memorial Day, there was a terrible rain and Brickell was left flooded. And I believe one of the pumps at the station there was down and has since has been repaired, right, Alan?
That's correct. That station has two pumps that are in it. As part of this preventive maintenance we were doing, we recognized some problems with the pump station. So we were doing repairs when the storm events happened in May. It caught us at that point. But we did complete those repairs, and the station is 100% operational.
The pumps operate are really designed for stormwater, so in other words, rain that falls. Is that fair to say, Alan?
Yes, it's part of the stormwater system.
Right, and then there's backflow valves that have been installed also in many low-lying neighborhoods, and those are designed to try to prevent higher seas from backing up into the streets. Is that accurate?
That's correct. Particularly where we had storm surge, it'll become more like a king tide event where water comes through the outfalls and then will come up onto the streets. And we put in, I believe, more than 100 one-way tidal valves in the most critical areas to prevent that from happening.
And I know in the past some of those valves, some of the trouble that you've experienced, perhaps unanticipated or not, they get caught open when debris gets flushed into them, either flushed into them in all likelihood from, you know, rising seas getting pushed up into those valves. How do you mitigate against that with this storm?
Well, no mechanical system is 100% guaranteed it's going to work. And so that's where that cleaning becomes so important. The more debris that we keep out of the pipe that can potentially block the valve open, the better it will perform during the storm itself. But it's really a matter of keeping that cleaning going throughout the system. We're trying to put in grates over the inlet that will prevent people from, if they drop a plastic bottle, from that getting into the system, or branches. At construction sites, we usually require them to put protective devices over the inlet so that construction debris doesn't get into the system. Those are the things that will block the valve open and prevent it from working properly.
We're talking about preparations for the rain portion of Hurricane Isaias, as it is a Category 1 storm here in the 1 o'clock hour on this Friday afternoon. 800-743-WLRN. Alan Dodd is with us, Chief Resiliency Officer, newly named to that position at the City of Miami. Alan, he's a longtime Corps of Engineers engineer and is the Director of the Department of Public Works in the City of Miami. Jenny Stiletovich is the environmental reporter for us here at WLRN. Jenny, what's the state overall of water within the South Florida Water Management District? When I looked online here today on this Friday morning, a number of those big conservation areas have red lights, meaning that they're full of water already.
Right. And so they are moving water south, trying to make more room in those. They began lowering the canals, I think a couple of days ago. I'm trying to remember when I talked to the district. I've lost track of time now. But they go through the system when they look at the forecast and they start lowering canals. They had lowered them, about a foot system wide. The water management district canals are sort of like the highways though. So they depend on the local drainage districts to make sure that their system systems are clean, like Alan was talking about. I mean, it seems like it should be more sophisticated than that, but really just kind of keeping storm drains clean and canals clear are what they depend on to get that water into the bigger district canals.
There's a couple of things as I think through 3 years ago with Hurricane Irma and what's changed in terms of resiliency. Number one, this community is talking a lot more about resiliency because of the experiences, Alan, from Hurricane Irma, both the social experiences, economic experiences, and of course the environmental experiences brought on by the storm surge and the wind driven water from Hurricane Irma, primarily here on the mainland. But also Miami voters okayed a bond program in 2017 that includes $200 million for projects to protect against sea level rise and floods. How has that money helped protect areas today for Hurricane Isaias?
Well, the Miami Forever Bond did provide $192 million for stormwater efforts. We've only spent a small portion of that so far. As you know, the first tranche of it was $58 million, but it was a smaller portion that went towards the stormwater. What we have been doing is really design work in most areas for the Brickell Bay project up in Jose Marti Park. Look at where we need big features, we're doing the design. We have done about 25 smaller flooding projects to alleviate hot spots, but those are smaller projects, and only a couple $1 million of that money has been expended so far. We are expecting to finish our stormwater master plan at the end of this year, and that really gives us the roadmap to some much bigger neighborhood-sized projects to address the long-term flooding challenges in the city. And that's where you'll see a lot of those Miami Forever Bond dollars being spent, is once we have that plan.
Will this storm, if it brings flooding, delay that planning at all, Alan?
It will not delay that. If this storm brings flooding, and we do anticipate that there will be some points, it will validate the models that we've created and the projects that we need to prioritize. But the planning really, it's been analyzing years of hotspots and trouble points and telling us what we need to do to prepare it for the next 50 years when we rebuild the infrastructure.
Jenny, the other big planning strategy that's been ongoing here is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Miami-Dade County. Talking about sea walls and other flood mitigation efforts, a massive, massive plan that is out for public comment right now. Tell us a little bit about that plan and how this storm could affect it.
Right. So that is a $4.6 billion plan. So it's pretty big. It involves floodgates across the Miami River. It involves elevating about 2,300 flood-prone structures. The point of that is to really harden areas around the bay from exactly this, from storm surge.
And does an event like Hurricane Isaias, as it happens during the planning process, how could that influence it?
Well, at this point, the plan is what I've been told is it's very conceptual. So what happens in the storm, I mean, they're not into the nitty gritty of the design yet. So I'm sure when they get to that point, which is probably years off, they'll take into account this storm, probably this next storm we're going to get. Each time we get hit, it's going to inform that the plans a little more. I will also point out that this plan only focuses on 7 vulnerable areas around the bay. That's just 7 areas.
Right. And Alan, I know you've got a long history with the Corps of Engineers as well. With its process and this kind of storm happening as the plan is out for public comment, could it influence what winds up getting implemented if something does?
Well, everything can influence that plan. But I think the important thing is we go into this storm event. We have a risk of flooding in low areas all along the Miami River. And we have some very large areas that are at risk right now. Once this plan is constructed, it would put in a surge barrier at the mouth of the Miami River that would provide that protection for future events. I think that There's a lot of discussion going on with the court plan. I think that this hurricane will bring more attention to the need to have better flood protection and particularly dealing with hurricanes and storm surge for the city, and get more of the public involved. The more feedback the court gets, the better that plan will be and the more responsive it'll be to what the needs of our residents are.
Alan, I know we're talking about a lot of big comprehensive plans, billion-dollar protection plans. We've gotten one call, though, and I know it's in the minds of a lot of people. Shelter, or rather shutters or no shutters? How about at the Dodd household?
I live in an apartment building, so I don't have that option.
You get to punt a little bit on that. Stiletovich, how about for you?
Oh, I live in an old 1920s house with foot-thick walls, so the windows are... Well, I'm not going to answer that question.
Okay, fair. Plead the fifth then on that one. Alan Dodd is the Chief Resiliency Officer for the City of Miami. Alan, thanks to you. Best of luck to you and your crew and your family. Jenny Stiletovich, the WLRN Miami environmental reporter. Jenny, thanks for your time, too.
Thank you, Tom.
Still to come, the first day of school in Miami-Dade will be a week later than first scheduled, but will begin online. That's next. We're back on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Miami-Dade County Public Schools will begin the school year fully online and a week later than originally scheduled. Distance learning for students begins August 31st. School originally was scheduled to reopen August 24th. This week, the district decided to delay back to school by a week as part of its response to the coronavirus pandemic. The CDC says kids are at a lower risk from the virus. So far, the state reports 5 pediatric deaths related to COVID-19 in Florida, but health experts say kids spread the coronavirus even if they're not showing symptoms. I spoke with Miami-Dade County Public Schools Superintendent Alberto Carvalho about the district's plan to reopen schools later this fall. We spoke via Skype. Superintendent Carvalho, welcome back to WLRN. Students won't be in their school buildings at the start of the year. Will teachers be in those classrooms?
First of all, good afternoon, Tom. Thank you for the opportunity once again. Yes, students will not be in their classrooms, but teachers will have an option. Certainly, if, since we're starting the school year, August 31st, fully online through a very robust new platform, they will have the option to do it from their homes. Or if they want to take full advantage of the technology and the tools they have in the classroom, they certainly will have the option to do it from there as well. You know, we're going to embrace this new phase of teaching and learning with compassion, with flexibility, with understanding for both our students, our families, as well as our teachers.
For the teachers to decide, what are the considerations that the administration is offering, and when do they have to make that decision?
Well, those are ongoing conversations right now that are being held between principals at the schools and the teachers, as you probably know. Student scheduling is not done centralized. It's done by principals at the individual schools. And that complex, intricate process of teacher-to-student match right now is the body of work that's it's unfolding at all 400-plus schools across Miami-Dade. So it's an ongoing process. A lot of our principals already have a pretty good idea based on the surveys we've done with teachers about special needs that certain teachers may have. Some specific to underlying health conditions, others specific to age, others under protections in the Extended Family Leave Act. For example, they may be caring for somebody who has COVID-19 or because of responsibility for children. So all those factors are going to be taken into account and considered as principals schedule the teachers. Look, we decided, as you know, to postpone the start of the school year by 1 week. We were originally scheduled to start August 24th, we're starting August 31st, but during that week, we're going to have a very intense training program for our teachers to really make them feel comfortable with this new powerful platform that will no longer force teachers and students or parents alike to go to different platforms, different applications to be connected to their learning. It's a one single stop shop for over 1,200 courses all in a very engaging, easy to use. So the user experience is going to be far superior. During that week period of time, there will be also an opportunity for parents and students to re-engage in a process and acclimatize themselves to the platform as well.
This platform is the one referred to as My School Online, is that correct?
That is correct. That is the one single platform, My School Online. It will be powered by very robust, strong technology through K-12.
That's the company, that's the service provider for this technology, K-12. It's a publicly traded company.
That is correct. That is the content provider for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. It is one of only two approved such providers in the state of Florida. We opted based on recommendations from teachers and principals and even our review for this platform. 1,200 courses will be embedded there, allowing still for the customization that teachers would do based on their own preferences. And I think this is the best way to approach, the beginning of this school year.
You mentioned allowing for preferences of teachers. So it's not a generic curriculum. Is that correct? So in other words, teachers will still have the ability to customize lessons, for instance?
Absolutely. The customization that belongs to each individual teacher is allowed and encouraged while they use this platform. What this platform does is it removes sort of that search and find, journey that a lot of parents had to deal with when we quickly transitioned from bricks and mortar schooling to online learning during the instructional continuity plan back in March. We had a lot of digital content, but it didn't all reside in the same platform. So teachers and students would have to log on to something, finish, log on to something else if they were going to go from math to language arts, and then still something else if they were going to social studies. As I said, this is a one-stop shop, very robust, very seamless, very easy to use. The user experience is much more enhanced. And another critical thing is it mimics, in terms of the schedule itself that students will go through, it mimics the classroom experience. Because remember, we announced that schooling online through My School Online begins August 31st. It will go through September 30th, hopefully. We will see an improvement in the local health conditions, perhaps allowing us September 30th to make an announcement about a return to the schoolhouse as early as October 5th, if the conditions allow it. And parents then will have an option to remain on My School Online, or as they have declared, because about 49% of the parents in our community declare that they would prefer, if the conditions allow, a traditional bricks and mortar education, to come back to our buildings. Obviously, finding buildings configured in a slightly different way with mitigation strategies, social distancing, et cetera.
The reopening of school buildings is on hold until at least October 5th, as you mentioned, with the decision coming in late September at the latest. This all depends on the local infection rates, targeting a number of 5% positivity rate for 14 days. Is that the metric you'll be looking at?
Well, we're actually looking at the recommended criteria, gating criteria, made available to us by our experts, who include some of the most extraordinary, talented people in medicine as well as public health. And we're actually looking at 8 specific metrics referred to as gating criteria to make a decision regarding a return to the traditional schoolhouse. One of the most important ones, obviously, is the sustained positivity rate of less than 10%. The 5% is a World Health Organization standard. In the U.S., 10% is used, but with the goal of it trending towards 5%. A steady reduction in the number of individuals hospitalized for COVID-19 or a flu-like symptom for 14 days, a sustained reduction in ICU bed occupancy due to COVID-19 also for 2 weeks, and a continuous reduced community viral burden, that's the total number of virus-positive individuals, also for 14 days. But in addition to that, I have to say that based on a recommendation of our experts, we need to see 2 additional things happening in our community. Both of them are totally outside the control of Miami-Dade County Public Schools. One is a much easier, more available testing, particularly of young people. And secondly, a much faster return of test results. And the recommendation is 48 hours. The reason for that is if you do not have test results back in 48 hours, then the effectiveness of contact tracing is rendered useless.
And what are county public health officials telling the schools to expect when it comes to the availability of testing children? Because there's been very few publicly available locations to test folks under 18 years old, as well as that reduction in results that are necessary.
Right. Look, I myself, after testing was made available in a more universal way, I didn't cut in line in front of anybody. I got tested myself. It took 10 days for me to get my test results. I'm COVID negative. But that's totally unacceptable, considering the expediency with which we will be working once schools open. Look, you may have an infected or somebody who develops symptoms while in school, a teacher or a professional, a student. And even though we will have isolation sites, two isolation rooms per school, you know, a number of triggers are pulled immediately. And for us to make effective decisions regarding isolation of individuals, quarantining of individuals, isolations of spaces in the school, one classroom, more than one classroom, the cross-pollination effect of children having siblings who attend other schools, right? For that level of almost automatic communication, which, by the way, we have the tool to do it.
Is it within the wherewithal of the school district to take on testing if the public health capacity isn't there in October?
We have not envisioned that. I think there are a number of hurdles associated with that. What we are hoping for, and in fact, this will be part of this month's upcoming month's board meeting, is the establishment of three testing sites specific to the MDCPS family.
Who would run those testing sites, Mr. Superintendent?
Well, we have partners, certainly you know, through Cigna, who is our medical claims administrative entity. We are looking at partnerships with local health providers to provide those tests. And again, if in fact we go in that direction, key for us is not just the access, the availability of the test, it's this guarantee that the test results are brought back rather swiftly, at least within a 48-hour time period, which right now is very much inconsistent with the average time that people are waiting for those tests.
You are listening to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, speaking with Miami-Dade County Public School Superintendent Alberto Carvalho about the district's reopening plan, a reopening a week later than originally anticipated. All students will be online for at least the first month of school. Teachers will be able to make a decision whether or not they teach from home or teach from their classrooms online. Mr. Superintendent, the State Board of Education, the commissioner, as you know, issued an executive order earlier in July ordering public school districts to reopen school buildings at least 5 days a week and have services available to parents. Has the state approved the Miami-Dade County reopening plan?
We just submitted our reopening plan to the state yesterday. Since that emergency order was published, we've certainly have received more flexible signals out of Tallahassee, even out of the federal government, that recognize that the one-size-fits-all to the reopening of America schools or Florida schools probably will not work because of the great variability of conditions, not only across the country, across states, but even within our own state. As you know, our positivity rate right now, which is the strongest indication of community spread, is at close to 18%. There are many areas of our state, if you go up to the Panhandle, where it may be below 5%. So those districts certainly will have no problem reopening. But I think more and more Tallahassee is recognizing, and the governor himself has acknowledged that districts that may be facing limiting circumstances like Miami-Dade, like Broward, like Palm Beach, like Monroe County, ought to be afforded some degree of flexibility, not only in terms of the timing when we open by, but how we open. But part of our plan, I want to be clear about one thing, is to provide a five-day-a-week model for parents when conditions allow it. All we're doing is we are delaying the start of that schoolhouse model because of local health conditions.
The executive order from the Education Commissioner, Richard Corcoran, ordered that school buildings open subject to the advice and orders of the Florida Department of Health or local health officials. Has Miami-Dade County Schools received such an order or such a recommendation from local Department of Health officials?
So one of our key advisors as part of the ad hoc health expert team that advises me and also advises the mayor of Miami-Dade County is the head of the local health department, which is an agency of the state health department. And that was one of several voices alongside a former Surgeon General of the United States of America, alongside the head of pediatrics for the University of Miami, alongside a leading epidemiologist for FIU. But she was one voice of support, unanimous support for our plan that really laid out the 8 criteria that I mentioned earlier for a safe reopening. And it is the criteria that is the foundation for the plan that was submitted to Tallahassee. So our plan is endorsed by the local health department, highest level authorizer, who is an arm of the state health department itself.
The plan that is in place now does call for kind of a review by late September, with the possibility of returning to the schoolhouse on October 5th, the first Monday in October. Mr. Superintendent, that's only for those families, those students that selected during the survey over the summer the option to go to the schoolhouse. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. And our community has been very clear and divided. 51% of the families decided that no matter what, they would prefer to continue through a remote learning, although a very enhanced remote learning process, My School Online.
For those families, does that mean they're online for the entire 2021 school year?
Unless they decide, and they will have an option at any one point, if they decide to re-enroll back in the schoolhouse, there is the opportunity to do so. And we've been very clear about that. So this is not a one-time decision that they're stuck with for the rest of the school year. There is the possibility, if at some point they decide, look, family circumstances have changed, professional responsibilities have changed, supervisory duties have changed, I would prefer my child to go back to the schoolhouse, or maybe my child is not doing as well as we would expect him to do online, needs the socialization, the social and emotional development is paying a price, then that child, those parents would have a right to re-enroll their child in the school. Remember, all of the children, whether they are in My School Online or at the schoolhouse, they're all enrolled to the same school. So it's just a matter of bringing the child back into the school. Obviously, we're going to be rather careful about the thresholds associated with utilization to maintain as much social distancing within the school as we possibly can.
And do those parents have that opportunity to return their child to the school building, assuming the school buildings reopen, at any point after that reopening, or are there specific windows of opportunity?
Now, we have not established windows. We are a flexible district. We understand that these are very, very different types of circumstances we're facing. And we're going to err on the side of the parental choice. If parents make decisions that are in the best interest of their children, after September 30th, we will accept that change of modality. Obviously, as I said earlier, we're going to pay close attention to a capacity in each school. We established a 75% threshold for school utilization, school space utilization, to not exceed what we believe is appropriate. To allow for, at least some degree of social distancing, managing the food distribution and the like. Based on parental selections, every one of our buildings falls within those protocols, so I think we will be fine. But yes, we will not deny a parent a chance to change modality at some time during this period of time leading to September 30th or after October 5th.
Alberto Carvalho, the superintendent of schools in Miami-Dade County. Superintendent, thanks for your time today.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
The Miami-Dade County Public School District is the broadcast license holder of WLRN, but the school district has no editorial control. Finally on the roundup, voting for the Florida primary. It's underway right now. Millions across the state have requested vote-by-mail ballots as the threat of the coronavirus pandemic remains. WLRN is asking listeners whether they plan to vote by mail this year.
Hi, I'm Audrey Morrow, and I live in Pembroke Pines. I'm definitely voting by mail this year. I voted by mail in the last 3 election cycles. I find it convenient, and I trust it. I personally just don't think it's worth the risk to wait in line. It's just not safe right now. Although things could change in November.
Election Day is August 18th, and we have a frequently asked question section about voting. You can find it on our website at WLRN.org. WLRN and the Miami Herald are also teaming up for a forum on the race for Miami-Dade County's next mayor. It will be live on the radio and streamed live video on Facebook and YouTube. It's next Friday, August 7th at 1 o'clock. You can find more details on our social channels and even submit questions you would like to hear from the mayoral candidates. You can find all that on the website at WLRN.org. And that'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's Director of Radio Programming is Jason Zabka. The Director of Radio Operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Denise Royal answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.